Hello and welcome to our podcast summary of activities supporting consistent application, covering the quarter to the end of September 2020. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and as ever, I'm here today with Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. And again, we're recording this podcast remotely, so we hope it all works smoothly. So I'm going to start with the Interpretations Committee meeting that took place in September 2020, where the committee discussed two topics. The first was the new submission on a particular sale and leaseback transaction, and the committee also provided input and advice on the board's deferred tax project related to leases and decommissioning obligations. Now, before I get into the technical detail, I'll just mention some changes at the committee table in September. We welcomed four new committee members, and those four were Donny Sefton from South Africa, Renata Bandiera from Brazil, Sophie Massol from France, and John Nelson from the US. And we also had two new board member observers at the table. Those were Rika Suzuki and Jianchao Li. Now, unfortunately, we weren't able to meet those new committee members in person, but we really hope that'll be possible soon, and we very much look forward to working together with them over the coming years. So moving on now to the technical topics, and we'll start with the new sale and leaseback submission. So our regular listeners to this podcast will know that the committee and the board has actually been spending quite some time on sale and leaseback transactions during 2020. The committee finalised an agenda decision in June on sale and leaseback transactions with variable lease payments, which dealt with the initial measurement of the right of use asset and associated liability. And the board has a narrow scope project on the subsequent measurement of sale and leaseback transactions on its agenda. And I'll mention that narrow scope project later in the podcast. And in this new submission, now rather than asking about how to apply the sale and leaseback requirements themselves, the question asked is really one about the interaction between IFRS standards. And in this case, it's the interaction between the consolidation standard IFRS 10 and the leasing standard IFRS 16. So first of all, what was the fact pattern? So in this case, an entity established a subsidiary some time ago and owns 100% of that subsidiary. And the subsidiary actually holds only one asset, a building, and has no liabilities. So that subsidiary is really a single asset entity. Now, the parent entity in this case then enters into a transaction, which is basically a sale of subsidiary and leaseback transaction. So it sells all of its interest in the subsidiary to a third party, losing control of that subsidiary. And then it also enters into a contract to lease the building back. Now, the carrying amount of the building immediately before the transaction is less than its fair value, and it's also less than the consideration paid. And the facts are such that the transfer of the building would meet the requirements in our revenue standard IFRS 15 to be accounted for as a sale. Now, what did the submitter ask? Well, they asked about the gain to be recognised on the transaction. So would the entity recognise the full gain on the sale? Or if applying the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16, would it recognise only the amount of the gain that relates to the rights transferred to the third party? And to clarify, the question asked was about the accounting in the entity's consolidated financial statements. So Sue, what were the main discussion points on the submission and what did the committee decide?
So another interesting question, aren't they always? But often the committee gets questions where there's no specific requirements in IFRS standards that apply to a transaction, and management needs to use the hierarchy in IAS 8 to determine what the appropriate accounting policy should be. But in this case, there's no lack of specific requirements. In fact, there's two sets of requirements that are relevant: requirements in IFRS 10 for the loss of control of a subsidiary, and requirements in IFRS 16 for sale and leaseback transactions. And it's because the transaction fits within both sets of requirements that the question's arisen. So on losing control of a subsidiary, an entity typically recognises the full gain or loss on sale, whereas in a sale and leaseback transaction, the gain is restricted. You only recognise the amount that relates to the rights that are transferred to the buyer lessor. But perhaps before going further, I'll first explain why the transaction is a sale and leaseback transaction in the first place. So paragraph 98 of IFRS 16 states that if an entity transfers an asset to another entity and leases that asset back, both entities account for the transfer contract and the lease, applying the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. And the basis for conclusions explains the board's use of transfer rather than sale in that paragraph. It was to ensure that no matter what the form of the transaction, the transfer of the asset that's leased back would be accounted for applying the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. So in this transaction, the entity loses control of the subsidiary and as a consequence loses control of the building. So it does transfer the building and leases it back. So both the loss of control requirements in IFRS 10 apply to the transaction and the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16 apply. IFRS 10, the entity derecognizes the building. Then applying the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16, the entity needs to decide whether the transfer of the asset is accounted for as a sale. And to do this, IFRS 16 requires the same test that's used in IFRS 15 to be applied. Now, in the submitted fact pattern, this was assumed to be the case as part of the facts that were submitted, so it wasn't something that the committee debated. But the committee's discussion and the tentative agenda decision explains that the reference to IFRS 15 within the sale and leaseback requirements doesn't mean that every sale and leaseback transaction is within the scope of IFRS 15. It just means that when you apply IFRS 16, an entity uses the same test as that used in the revenue recognition standard, and that's achieved by cross-referring to this part of IFRS 15. So in this case, because the transfer of the asset satisfies the requirements to be a sale, the entity needs to apply paragraph 100A of IFRS 16, which sets out how to initially measure the right of use asset and consequently the gain or loss to be recognised on the transaction. In summary, the tentative agenda decision concludes that the outcome of applying the loss of control requirements in IFRS 10 in combination with the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16 in the transaction that was discussed, is that the entity would recognise a gain on the transaction that reflects the requirements in paragraph 100A of IFRS 16. So it would only recognise the amount of the gain that relates to the rights transferred to the third party. It would not recognise any gain or loss relating to the right of use that it retains via the leaseback transaction.
Great. Thanks, Sue. And so the committee's conclusions on this sale and leaseback transaction are included in a tentative agenda decision that is now out for comment. That tentative agenda decision also actually includes our worked examples, and which, by the way, includes, exciting for me, some debits and credits. I always understand things better with debits and credits. And so with that, we very much look forward to receiving your comments. And the comment deadline for that tentative agenda decision is the 23rd of November. Now, I mentioned earlier that at its September meeting, the committee also provided views on the board's project on deferred tax that relates to leases and decommissioning obligations. I don't plan to talk about that project further now, but we'll do so when the board next discusses it. And that's actually expected to be very soon, discussions planned for October. So we're going to move on now from the committee meeting. And I think actually listeners would probably be interested in some of the recent changes that were made to the due process handbook, and in particular changes that relate to the role of agenda decisions. So maybe again, I'm going to ask you to walk through some of these main changes.
Sure. So the due process handbook, for those who don't know, is basically the requirements that the board and the committee are required to abide by when we are doing our standard setting and sort of technical decision making activities. And it's something that's signed off by a committee of the trustees, our oversight body, the Due Process Oversight Committee, and they issued some updates in August. And the main part of those changes related to agenda decisions. So what's in the process handbook? So the first thing that the Due Process Handbook now confirms is that agenda decisions cannot add to or change requirements in IFRS standards. So it's setting out, you know, what is an agenda decision. And goes on to say that explanatory material that we now often include in agenda decisions explain how the existing principles and requirements apply to the particular fact pattern or transaction that's described in the agenda decision. The second point that's clarified in the due process handbook is to say that agenda decisions can, even though they're based on an application of existing requirements, they can provide additional insights. And that might change an entity's understanding of the IFRS requirements. And as a result, it may lead to a need to change the accounting policy. And when that's the case, the handbook notes that an entity should be entitled to sufficient time to implement any such change. The third point that the handbook says about agenda decisions is that they derive their authority from IFRS standards. Therefore, if an entity's accounting isn't aligned with a relevant agenda decision, it's not compliant with IFRS standards. That's an important confirmation in the handbook. And finally, because agenda decisions are so important and because we're now using them more actively and are including more content in them, the Due Process Oversight Committee decided to strengthen the due process around agenda decisions. And it's done that by involving the board in the agenda decision process. So now, before an agenda decision is finalised, the board will be asked whether they object to the finalisation of that agenda decision. If no more than three board members object, the agenda decision will be finalised. And as I said, this really reflects the increasingly important of agenda decisions and supporting consistent application. We thought it was important that the board is also comfortable with what those agenda decisions say.
So moving on then from due process, we will continue our sale and leaseback theme of this podcast and mention progress that the board has made on its narrow scope sale and leaseback project at its September meeting. So on the last podcast, we explained that the board had decided to add a narrow scope project to specify how to subsequently measure the lease liability that arises in a sale and leaseback transaction. And that was really, by the way, to fill a gap in the sale and leaseback requirements. So the requirements already there in IFRS 16 address initial measurement. And that was the subject of the agenda decision finalised in June on sale and leaseback transactions with variable lease payments. However, there are no specific subsequent measurement requirements for the lease liability that arises from the transaction, and that could result in inconsistent application for transactions that are very often material to entities that enter into them. So in September, the board decided to include one additional piece to this narrow scope project, and that is it decided to propose to specify the method to use on initial measurement of the right of use asset and lease liability. So the exposure draft, expected to be published in November, will not only address subsequent measurement of the lease liability, but it'll also specify that a seller lessee should initially measure the right of use asset and lease liability arising from the leaseback at the present value of the expected lease payments. And the discount rate used there will be the interest rate implicit in the lease or the seller lessee's incremental borrowing rate, as is normal when applying IFRS 16. So finally, Sue, could you maybe talk about IBOR?
Yes. So as planned, the board issued the IBOR Phase 2 amendments package in August. And these amendments in this final and last phase of our work on IBOR relate to changes in contractual cash flows and hedging relationships that arise as a result of IBOR reform. So essentially, we've confirmed that simplified accounting would apply when changes are made to financial assets and financial liabilities or to hedging relationships that just reflect changes made necessary by the reform and that don't go further than that. If that's the case, then when there's a change in contractual cash flows, an entity would simply update the effective interest rate to reflect the change to the alternative benchmark rate. And in the case of hedge accounting, there would be no discontinuation of an existing hedge accounting relationship solely because of changes that are made that are required by IBOR reform. Importantly, there's some new disclosures that come with these amendments, and those disclosures are required to provide information about any changes in risk management that are arising from the reform and how an entity is managing the transition and its progress in managing the transition to alternative benchmark rates. Now, I know everybody groans a bit when we talk about new disclosures, but we've tried to be proportionate and we've really focused on information being provided that meets particular objectives. And we did it that way to give preparers flexibility to decide what was the most sort of efficient and cost-effective way for them to provide information that would meet those disclosure objectives. We hope that these amendments, along with the ones that we published last year for IBOR, will help entities who are having to process changes to deal with IBOR reform. And that would also enable them to provide information to investors who are really interested to understand the effects of this reform on reporting entities.
Great. Thank you, Sue. And that's it for this podcast. That now brings our podcast to a close. Thank you, Sue, for being with me again today. And thank you all for listening. We hope you found the podcast useful. As ever, please email communications@ifrs.org. if you have suggestions for improvement. So take care, thank you, and goodbye.